Yes, so thanks, and thanks for inviting. It's very interesting gathering. So, and what is going to happen today is quite different from the previous 3 days, where people seem to have had very common frame of ideas and everything. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit from those previous days and speak indeed mostly about phenotypic variation, but not really about Drosophila only. In fact, I will try to keep it balanced between plants and Drosophila, and I will show you, or I intend to show you, 4 different pieces of research, one of which we accomplished together with Tom Turner and Erik von Wedberg, and both of them are employed by USC and UCD. I moved from University of California, Davis, to University of South California something like a year ago, and those guys followed me. So the second piece will be a collaboration with Peter Chang from USC and Brian Bilks from UCD. The third piece will also be collaboration with Ryan Bickel from USC and Artem Kopp from UCD. Tom is my grad student, Eric postdoc, Peter grad student, Brian Bilks is collaborator, postdoc in the lab of Luca Camai, Ryan Bickel is postdoc from my lab, Artem Kopp is our valuable collaborator. And the fourth piece will be collaboration with Lauren McIntyre and Marta Wayne, they're in University of Florida, Gainesville, and Larry Harshman, he is in the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. So I kind of was trying to understand what might be interesting for you, so I splashed together a few topics. So first I will give you very short and very informal introduction, then I will be speaking about genetics of local adaptation of Lyrata coming from QTLs to model selection. Then I will try to answer questions that might be of importance and relevance to you. Is outcrosser better than selfer? And we will see what does it mean better and in what sense. So this will be about plants, and I don't know how like to do break, that would be natural break, but then we can speak about gene-level association studies, Bricke, Brack, and Drosophila melanogaster. And finally, I will try to switch a little bit to variation and pathways, and how it scales into phenotypic variation. I will show you some transcriptome data, and I will focus on insulin-TOR pathway in Drosophila. And that piece is kind of half published. That piece is completely unpublished. That piece is completely unpublished, and this is like one third published. So it's all new data. So, and the shift, as I promised, it will be like that. You guys were speaking about molecular evolution. So what you are speaking is the following. There are some segregated nucleotides, right? You assume that they translate into variation in phenotypes. So you assume, for example, that if some sequence in some position has C instead of normal nucleotide, then individuals which have C in that position will fall into one tail of phenotypic distribution for some character. And then what you are trying to understand it is how natural selection is shaping that pattern of segregating polymorphisms. And this shaping variation. So you are envisioning tons of tests to look for departures from expected distributions of frequency distributions. So this is one, and envision a bunch of tests for that. And this is one level at which evolution is studied. The second level, for which we have tons of information from traditional evolution and from ecology, is evolution of phenotype, in which we take those distributions either from of frequency distributions of phenotypic variation, and we try to understand how that distribution is shaped and is deformed by natural selection. We can estimate intensities of selection for phenotype strengths of selection. So this is 2 levels at which evolution is studied. The problem is that they are not really independent from each other. And what you ultimately want to do, it is to understand explicitly how those nucleotides are shifting phenotype in relation to population mean, how selection is acting on variation and of actual phenotypes, and then predict how that selection is going to direct the distribution of probabilities of fixations or maintenance of variation at molecular evolution level. And this connection is claimed to be done by quantitative genetics. So this is domain of my research, quantitative genetics, how to get from here to here in a meaningful way, trying to integrate those two levels. So, and traditional approach to quantitative genetics is the following. Let's treat organism as a black box. On one side of this black box is some information about markers, be it SNPs or microsats or whatever, or your HapMap projects. And on the other side, it is written what phenotype this black box has. And then we are looking for statistical associations, and mostly we analyze outliers. So this is very interesting exercise in which you are making your conclusions with very complex and not completely understand statistics on the basis of analysis of outliers. So a bunch of conclusions that we derive as a result of that are biased by a known amount in unpredictable direction, and especially complex in this sense are association studies and QTL mapping studies. So what we are trying to do instead, we've been engaged in all that horrible business of mapping and making inferences for quite some time, but about 10 years ago we kind of stopped doing it, and we decided to try to understand what is sensible that is possible to do instead. So this is, intention was the following, that when, like, I die, and when Angelov Robertson at the judgment time asks me whether or not I claim that like 90% of phenotypic variation is accounted by 5 segregating QTLs, I would be able to say no. So this is my justification for trying to understand how to do stuff in different way. But what you will see as a result, it is some incoherent attempts to do it in different ways, just opening this box and trying to like scramble through those RNA pathway information and trying to understand what sensible conclusions could I make out of it. So this is what I'm going to do or try to do, and I will appreciate as many questions or ideas or like expressions of annoyance as possible, because it will help us think further. And here I'm done with my introduction, and I want to start on the first topic, except if you have questions about why I'm so kind of skeptical about what was happening for a long time, or in the middle of the process, I will be able to answer it as well. So I will be speaking about our attempt to do genetics of local adaptation in Arabidopsis lyrata. We entered plant world about 3 years ago and are coming up with first papers. So what is the setup here? Instead of taking a couple of genotypes, recombining them, and try to understand what is going on, we decided to take into account ecology. And we were looking for the case where there is a following setup. Normally, Arabidopsis lyrata lives on soils with appropriate composition of ions. On those granite soils, there is appropriate composition of calcium, magnesium, other ions, which make cells functioning without stretch. This is what those plants apparently were adapted for a long, long time. But in some wonderful and spectacular pieces of universe, like California or Pennsylvania, there are outcrops of very strange soils, which are called serpentine soils. And in those soils, ion concentrations are very shifted. Like they have a bunch of boron, calcium, magnesium concentrations are very difficult, so plants are challenged to grow there. But what really is happening, it is that there are large populations on granite, like interspersed all over here, but there are very few populations which manage to grow on serpentine. So this is the first important piece of information. Second important piece, so you can think about those blue populations and as about source populations. But then those populations are kind of immigrants who are able to survive on alternative soils, right? Those populations are not very frequent. We don't know whether or not they are independent from each other, those cases of local adaptation. They are kind of hard to find. But what is important to note is that Lyrata, unlike Arabidopsis thaliana, is obligate outcrosser. So there is tons of gene flow here. And if you just take whatever you call neutral markers, if such are in existence, you will see tons of gene flow and very low population stratification between those populations. And if you see any population stratification, it will be distance, not designation by soil type. So this is ecological setup. What we want to do is starting from that setup. So let me first kind of describe a little bit. Let's focus on nickel, which is one of predominant problems for plants on serpentine soil. So this is Arabidopsis lyrata that grows on normal soil. And what we assume is that in that normal populations which grow on normal soil, there are some alleles segregating which could potentially enable those plants to deal with soils which have high concentration of nickel. So some plants, if they are transplanted or if they are transmitted to those serpentine locations, they will happily die, and other populations will survive and form local populations, which we call soil adapted.
So what is this assumption justified? Because you technically may think that if mutation target for living in high nickel is very large, then instead of high frequency segregating alleles in the population living heavily in granite, you would have just new mutational event which make this adaptation. So
it could be. I'm not claiming what is the frequency distribution of those alleles in granite populations. All I'm saying is that this is nearly ideal setup to see local selection sweeps, because there is tons of gene flow. I'm not trying to say that there is steady-state distributions of allele frequency in one location or another location, and we can model sampling from one location to explain distribution in the other location. All I'm saying it is that I envision that some areas of the genome will be differentiated. So the mental picture is like that. So suppose I have some LD blocks in population, population growing on normal soil, and then those plants which sample, which self-select, which adapt to grow on weird soils, they will have some sweeps. And I don't know, will it be complete sweeps? Will they go to fixation, right? Or they will be, if they are sampled from pre-existing variation, it might be a sweep of not single allele, but of multiple alleles. But at least my hope is that I will see differentiated regions of the genome. In overall gray picture of non-differentiated regions of the genome, because there is no real population stratification, there is good evidence for gene flow. You have another question? Okay. So this is hope, and how we can detect it at whole genome level. Well, we kind of started to do it 3 years ago, a couple of years ago, when Celexa was not yet that prominent. So we decided to use Tilin Arabidopsis arrays. At which point there was second generation Tilin array. What is Tilin array? I don't know. Like, there are some physicists here, or do I need to tell you what it is or not? So what is Tilin array is the following weird creature. Imagine that this is a chunk of chromosome. Imagine that you know the sequence here. So you have ability to put oligonucleotides which correspond to that sequence onto the surface of some surface, like grow them on chip. And those will be 25 bases, each of them. And the distance between the centers is approximately 50 bases. not 50 plus 35, 85 bases. So there are some gaps, but overall those 3 million of oligonucleotides cover about 60% of the genome. Correspond to 60% of the genome. What is the kick here? That if you extract DNA, for example, from this plant, and you shear it to little pieces, and then you hybridize to microarray which contains 3 million of those features, if your plant doesn't have perfect match, sequence match with this oligonucleotide, which is positioned on the chip, but it has some mismatch, some position, intensity of hybridization will be decreased. So you can use it as a marker. And this is a shitty marker, because there is tons of false negatives associated with it. But the point is that natural scale of linkage disequilibrium in Arabidopsis lyrata is about 5 kb. So if you have 5 kb linkage disequilibrium block, you can count that on that 5 kb, you will have about, 50, 60 oligonucleotides, right? So you have enough oligonucleotides. So some of them will give you reliable signals of the lack of hybridization as a result of mismatch, right? So you have 3 million of very bad markers, but it is so many that you can extract some information from that. Make sense? Or shall I go into more detail? Okay. So the problem is so what we decided to do, we took couple populations from normal soil, couple of populations from serpentine soil, extracted DNA, splashed on three chips each to a total of 12 arrays, which costs about nothing. And of course the problem is that we were using Taliana arrays and we were analyzing Lyrata, and Lyrata is different. So there are, as I mentioned, about 3 million of those oligonucleotides on array. So we blasted them all with Lyrata draft of genome. We saw that 400,000 are still matches, which is still decent number of markers. The genome is reasonably compact, it is 500 million. So, and then we tried to understand which of them are significantly differentiated between populations, between normal soil and serpentine soil, rich in nickel. And with 400,000 tests to do, for example, if you analyze oligonucleotide by oligonucleotide, we still have about 30 significant after-Bonferroni correction. So they're hugely significant between populations. Means that in one population, they consistently hype, and in other populations, they consistently don't hype. So they're positioned in according number of genes. Then a bunch of them were significant after reasonably conservative FDR correction.
You may be going in this direction, but this study design, it looks very surprising in the following sense, that this is an association study. And what people try to do in association studies, they try to remove geographic structure or any population structure from the analysis. Mm-hmm. So what you do here is very different, because you're trying to find signals of local adaptation. And you cannot remove geographic structure. So if you have this 28 or 72, how do we know whether this is structure of the population which is purely geographic or it's biologically significant?
This is a wonderful question. And ideally, what I would have done, I would have used many more populations, right? I would use, for example, 10 serpentine populations instead of 2. The problem is I don't have them. There are no big populations growing on serpentine. And if you are speaking about some little intrusion someplace close to normal soil, you don't really know, is it differentiated population, is it adapted population, or it is crap. So we are now in collaboration with Scotland guys who found more serpentine populations in Scotland to see exactly that. Good news is that there is no real evidence for population stratification except for those guys. The picture is reasonably striking, that you have the genome completely meshed except for very few locations. And if you count this single feature analysis with the following analysis, you just take chromosome. Because again, the signals from your markers are very noisy, right? But the signal becomes less noisy if you integrate information from a bunch of markers, right? So you can take window analysis and you can ask a question, okay, do I see more significant features within the window than I expected by chance at given p-value? So you can deal with the common probability and you can make this sliding window analysis. And what we see? We see that there are a couple of hundred of significantly differentiated genes, and the rest of genome appears completely meshed. I don't know how it could be consistent with the picture of population stratification rather than the trace of selection. But again, this is very, very imprecise conclusion, but you will see how I will try to turn around this conclusion to move forward. The question is, and this is a question as much to you as it is to me, how surprising it is that you will see a couple of hundred genes which are involved in local adaptation. Is it surprising or not? Because if you compare it with QTL analysis, standard type of QTL analysis, people will claim that might be five genes explain everything, or 60% of variation, or whatever. And here we are dealing with as simple local adaptation as possible. It's like soil type, right? And there are a couple of hundred genes. So I don't quite know how to think about it. Oh yeah, and I forgot to get another, to get to another point. Suppose all of that is geographical structure. Nothing related to adaptation whatsoever. Then you would assume that those genes would be random subsample of functions, right? Those differentiated genes. In fact, if you take those couple hundred genes, what you will see? Membrane proteins, transporters, potassium ion transport channels, cellular calcium ion homeostasis genes. Those are the most enriched categories. Cation transport. And you mentioned that you were studying ice plant and its adaptation to high soil, right? So this is a favorite gene, which is a homolog of ice plant gene, which was molecular biologists show it was responsible for ability to deal with ions. So just some population genetics example, just a sec, of the following nature. In very sequenced it in bunch of copies, in bunch of plants from populations, and in normal soils, within 70 base window, for example, some 70 base window, eight amino acids, non-synonymous polymorphisms, are among 23 amino acids segregating. So that's huge. But only one of them is fixed on serpentine soils, as you would expect in accordance with our picture. So if you don't believe that it is selection, that it is like trace of selection, I don't know what you would believe, right? But okay, so apologies.
Yeah, about the, so, okay, not referring to the specific example, but with reference to the enrichment with the Go annotation, you could have some other property of these proteins, which would cause actually, for example, if you have a higher fraction of neutral.
You are 100% correct. If, for example, there is more variation, somehow, predominantly in membrane proteins, there is more variation, right? So we just more frequently sample those. Sure, it could be.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I know answers. I'm merely giving you experimental data, right? So keep in mind that I'm in different positions from most of you. What you have huge data sets that was generated by somebody. And then you are scrambling through that in all ways you can think of, right? I'm generating my little data sets to answer my specific questions. I want to understand what is different between those populations, and I show it to you. This is what it is. Interpretation of this data is as much your business as mine. I'm an experimentalist.
Has anything known about how how long ago Eruvidopsis would have adapted to?
We do not. Absolutely no evidence. But and the problem is that we don't really know how ancient those alleles are. We need to do a bunch of resequencing to go for that. So that's one problem that we should probably deal with. But let me tell you why I think that it is kind of cute and why it is important to switch, to my mind, to population genetics. First, 200 genes are divergence, which is very, very sad for me. I don't know, as experimentalist, I don't know how to go forward. Most of people, when they're dealing with adaptation, it is like some change, right? You see what is the most important or couple of the most important things, and then you beat it to death with biochemistry and everything, right? How the hell do I deal with 200?
But now, you started out talking about 3 million, and that covers 60% of the genome, maybe. But then you were down to a tenth that number. So actually, your probes are only covering maybe on the order of 5%.
Okay, let me make a very bold statement. I do cover not whole genome. I cover only 60% of the genome. But I think that I have enough power to detect every selection sweep, because LD block is much larger than the distance between markers.
Even with the
300,000. That's right.
Sweep is strong. So these 200, most of these, you're really seeing what appears to be, on these chips at least,
right,
fixation of?
Yeah. I don't know, are they fixations or just allele frequency difference? I'm not even sure, is it one allele or mix of alleles? And actually, we are doing some of that to answer that question, which is we take the same population, we took the same populations, we resequence them, we select to 60x coverage, and we are analyzing the data. And basically, we see exactly that. We see the same genes, we see about the same number of genes. Again, the problem with selection and with population, so we resequence not individuals, we resequence population samples. So again, because reads are 35 bases, we have no way how to reconstruct alleles, right? So still we cannot do phylogeny because it is all scrambled, right? But at least we see exactly the same signatures.
Okay, because my question is, by some perhaps conservative set of criteria given the experimental technique, you see 200, and I was wondering whether that really means there's 2,000.
I am decently sure that it is not 2,000, but I am biased. And let me see, let me explain you why I'm biased in this way.
I have a technical question. I don't know whether this is important or not, but as far as I understood, your array comes from Taliani array.
That's right.
So if there is a region of the genome which underwent adaptation between Lirata and Taliana, you would bias yourself.
That's precisely correct, yeah. I must say that what I showed you as a picture, it is the difference between perfect match and mismatch, right? Mm-hmm. But in reality, your power is slightly less, but in reality, you see difference between single mismatch and double mismatch. So we can actually add all mismatches to our data set, and we will see like extra 50 genes, but not that much.
Before you went into the study, were there any genes that you knew?
No, we did not.
None.
It's a new system. We know from other organisms, right?
Yeah, no, I just wondered.
So, for example, those functional annotations which I mentioned, they are from Taliana. Right. So my logic is the following. This is very depressing that I need to deal with like 200 genes at least, but this is positive spin on it. As quantitative geneticist, what is very important for me to know, it is that what I don't have to deal with, it is 30,000 genes minus 200. So not only I know that 200 genes are diverged, I know that 28,800 are not diverged. And this is much more important for me. Or not diverged, but let me make slightly different claim. They are not involved in adaptation because I do not see allele differences between them, between soil types.
So what's the definition of diverged and not diverged? I mean, what's a big enough difference in allele frequency to...
Let me respond as experimentalist, right? If something doesn't have allele frequency differences more than 5%, which is, say, intensity of gene exchange between those populations, I don't care. Now, why it is important?
Still, in reality, perhaps you have a sensitivity that might only let you see things that are minimum of 20%. You couldn't detect 5%.
Well, again, with Selexa, we have 60 times coverage. So wait for that paper to come.
Yeah.
It will be in a couple of months. So why it is important for me to know that there are 200 genes and the rest I can just safely ignore? Because what is the standard setup of QTL mapping procedure? You take two genotypes of your interest. You let them recombine, right? You make recombinant inbreed lines. And then you engage in the painful process of mapping your effects along chromosomes. What I propose to do is slightly different. Suppose that I know that those 200 genes are different, and I'm willing to assume as a first approximation that the rest I don't care about. Then suppose I have exactly the same music, exactly the same lyrics, but the sense is completely different of the song, right? I have my recombinant inbreed lines. I know in those recombinant inbreed lines, in each of them, what is the set of alleles in that line, right? I know what is the set of alleles in each recombinant inbreed line for those 200 genes, right? So in a sense, I'm saying, okay, this genotype has number 10, 15, 25 originating from this soil and another from another soil, right? Then it becomes not a mapping procedure. It becomes model selection procedure. It becomes estimation procedure of effects of those individual genes. And they can use priors. One of my priors might be allele frequency difference, right, between populations. Another of my priors might be biological function of those genes, right? If they're engaged in ion transport, might be I will weight them higher than some genes with unknown functions. So I have priors, I have 200 genes, and all I need to do it is to do model selection to understand which of genes are becoming my primary candidates for further study. And I think that instead of, and you see that nothing changed, right? The material is still the same. Inference making, I hope, will become completely different, and we will generate perhaps more sensible conclusions from that than from QTL mapping.
I have one question about model selection procedure, because it comes back to experience of explaining my very little knowledge of quantitative genetics to computer scientists. Because if you consider full model with 200 genes, you have a combinatorial explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you do main effects, pairwise effects, and so forth, mm-hmm. then this is what he called polynomial thinking.
Shamil.
Because you can have very complex situation here, because you already said that you have a rule, this idea of 5 QTLs to 200, and it can be...
You are precisely right. Let me answer in the following way. What I would do before engaging in model selection, perhaps, it is to try to estimate how much is accounted by marginals, how much of variation, how much by interaction terms, right? And then I would weight again my interaction terms and main effect terms in accordance with those priors. I don't know all the answers. All I am saying it is that unfortunately or fortunately, I think that we are over naive stage and we actually need to try to understand what to do. And hopefully we have enough tools to attempt to do it at least. Okay.
How many of these recombinants of these recombinations
I have no clue. I'm not even sure that we are going to go forward with that. My lab is weird animals. We have like 20 projects like that going at any given time. So I randomly selected 4 for you. But what people will want to do what stuff, I am clueless. I don't know.
No, I just meant because that would determine that sort of how deep you can go into this combinatorics, what Shamil just mentioned.
Yeah, that's right.
You can do marginals or
that's right.
Order.
Absolutely, I don't know. But those are all kind of questions to think about. But my only claim is that we probably have enough kind of background to start thinking about them seriously. Not that people didn't think about them. There are tons and tons of different procedures to do QTL analysis. The problem is that they don't really move us forward that much. It's like beating the same dead horse, right?
Sergey, could you explain again why you're so happy that like so many genes are not divergent? How does that help?
Because I can completely ignore them. They're zeros. the effect on QTL. The importance for this particular case of adaptation is zero. I shall ignore something. This world is way too complex, right? I'm happy to ignore them. Okay.
Are there some technical problems in creating the recombinant inbred lines in an obligate outcrosser?
There is, and this is why it was never done. David Remington in Greensboro is now trying to do it. Those people believe that they cannot do recombinant inbred lines from outcrosser. I don't understand why, because the only stuff that will keep segregating is incompatibility locus, right? Who cares?
Do you know whether you are observing an excess of new variants or derived variants in this adapted environment?
Say it one more time, apologies.
You have that Taliana sequence and you have that Arrieta. Uh-huh. You are detecting, you have sequence data.
Uh-huh.
Do you see an excess of derived variants?
I do not know. We are dealing with low-level analysis with Lyrata data, like making annotating it cross-genome because the genome was like privately released about a week ago, et cetera, et cetera. So we are not there yet, but we will be there. Okay. Uh-huh.
Sorry, just backing up to your answer to Marty's question. Can you go over that a little more slowly because I missed...
I will be happy to do it later if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
So let me move to the next point, which is probably, which is not really about quantitative genetics, but might be it will be related to you somewhat. Is outcrosser better than sulfur? And we will see in what sense. So this is again about Arabidopsis. But it is with a focus on slightly different species. So I was speaking about Arabidopsis lyrata subspecies lyrata, which is here on phylogenetic tree. And now I will be speaking about Arinosa and Taliana. So those two guys diverged from each other about 5 million years ago. So sequence divergence between them is about 5% in coding regions. And then plants appeared after diverging from each other for 5 million years. They decided to like remarry each other, right? So they formed allotetraploid, and it happened about 30,000 years ago. So they formed species which is called Arabidopsis suecica. This is extremely weird because if you think that genome evolved independently for 5 million years, right, experiencing duplications, deletions, functional fractionalizations, like you name it, and then they engage in happy marriage and survive and whatever. But what is important for me, it is the following question. Okay, what happens? Now you have in every locus four alleles, right? And some of those alleles might be functionally divergent from each other, some are not. Some are redundant, some are less redundant. So how frequently you will lose those alleles? Will it be random bias subsample of how you lose them in relation to function, for instance? Or if you silence some of alleles originating from one of species, are they clustered together? Or if some allele silenced which belongs to certain genetic network, does it mean that the gene which is interacting with that allele is also going to be silenced for the same parent of origin, right? So there are all tons of questions which, amusingly enough, are not really addressed. So we, again, a couple of years ago, engaged in a simple project to do it, to try to understand what is going on here.
Did that 30,000-year estimate just come purely from some kind of biogeographic?
No, it comes from tons of resequencing that Magnus have done. So it's just how far allele strays. Plus to biogeographic evidence.
Yeah. Because it's pretty difficult to
They sequence tons of stuff and they can give you explicit citations.
What is N?
This is number of chromosomes. So this is setup. Now, what can we do? So we have Taliana, we have Arinosa, we have Suecica, which formed from them. We have artificial F1 sample. This is collaboration with Brian Dilks from Luca Kamai's lab. And finally, we have DNA and RNA samples from all of those. Why this is important? So let me come back to those chips. Imagine that it is 5% sequence divergence in coding regions. Suppose in that tiling array there are about 40 oligonucleotides per transcript. Out of those 40 oligonucleotides per transcript, all of them are expected to match Teliana genome, because this is what chip was designed from. But only 20 will hybridize with arenosa allele, cause of sequence divergence. So for every transcript, we have 20 markers, right? 20 markers is plenty to see whether or not both alleles are represented in DNA sample. Only one of them. 20 alleles are further plenty. 20 markers are further plenty to estimate what fraction of one allele and what fraction of another allele is represented in RNA pool for that gene. So we can estimate whether or not alleles were deleted in parent of origin specific way, and whether or not they were silenced in parent of origin specific way for every transcript in the organism.
But there's got to be an obvious bias against the one species, right? Even there's
bias originating from what?
You said 20 probes will be identical matches in arenosa.
Mm-hmm.
Nah.
Yeah, but then only some fraction will actually have a sequence difference in arenosa. That could be informative.
Okay, let me show you the data, and then we will deal with all biases, yeah, right?
Which of the probes have a mismatch?
Yeah. That's an excellent point. I will describe that.
So can we think about this as allelic specific expression experiment?
Yes, absolutely. This is allelic specific expression experiment. In the case where you have 20 markers per transcript, right? Each of which is noisy. Mm-hmm. That's right. And again, it was pre-Selexa time when we started to do it, and it took us about a year to understand how the hell to deal with the problems that Molly mentioned. How the hell do I ID those nucleotides, which are different? And so this is how it looks. We have, for example, this DNA. So we take Teliana, and we take Teliana DNA and we splash with onto chips, and this red distribution is distribution of 3 million hype signals from what is called perfect matches. This is what is expected to be present on the base in the genome on the basis of sequence strain of Teliana. This is distribution of mismatches. This is control oligonucleotides with single mismatch in comparison with expected. And what you see is that, yeah, those chips actually kind of work, right? Those distributions are very different from each other.
That mismatch, it's predicted? Or
so you take Teliana sequence, right? You base chip on that. Then you scramble Teliana. You put on that chip, so you expect to see 3 million matches. In reality, you don't see 3 million matches. You see some shoulder here, which is from the fact that two different accessions of Teliana were used, one for sequencing and another in our experiments. And this is population of mismatches. Those are exactly the same oligonucleotides, except they have one nucleotide in the middle different from expected.
It's a different chip.
It's on the chip. So there are on the chip 6 million probes total for some internal affymetrix reasons. And that is distribution of perfect matches, and this is distribution of mismatches with Teliana. So let's look at arenosa, which is on the left, right? So this is now distribution of perfect matches to Teliana, right? and distribution of mismatches, right? So that part of the distribution, I hope, it might be, we can envision procedure in which we can still identify what perfect matches can be used as our markers, which are still perfect matches in arenosa. And the rest of oligonucleotides move to the domain which is no different from mismatches, right? This is those oligonucleotides which evolve sequence mismatches over 5 million years divergence. And then we can do the same with hybrids. So this is F1 hybrid, artificial hybrid that was made in Luca Camai's lab. And this is natural Sueshika. And this is what we are doing. We are playing with those 3 million dot distributions to understand what the heck is going on.
Uh-huh. But don't you want to look at the markers on each transcript separately?
Yes, absolutely. I just show you summary pictures, but of course we are dealing with every transcript separately.
I expect some kind of uniform level for these different markers. And
okay, let me show you raw data. This is raw data. This is how it looks along transcript. So this particular transcript has given number of oligonucleotides which cover it along the length, right? And some of those, for example, this is Taliana signal, this is arenosa signal. This is F1 signal. Of course, we are doing everything with huge replication. So we can understand what is error and what is real. And this is what we are doing. What we need to do it is to establish procedure. First, we have different chips, right? So what we need to understand it is which oligos don't look different from each other for hybridization signals, right? So those oligos, say there are 10 of them per transcript, we can use to normalize chips to the same mean within transcript, right? Then after that normalization, we look at those which are different, and we classify them. For those which are we classify them to, for example, given high hybridization signal in Taliana and low hybridization signal in arenosa, and this is our markers. So this is kind of iterative procedure where with each transcript we should deal individually to call our oligonucleotides for diagnostic and not diagnostic. And there is some decent amount of stats associated with it. So this is, for example, what we would do for this gene. We would call this as Taliana-specific probe, this as Taliana-specific probe, this as Taliana-specific probe, this one. And this is what we are using for detecting allele-specific expression. And we filter out all the cases in which whatever signal we are dealing with, we estimated on less than 10 oligos. 10 oligos. Which, by the way, human SNP chip, now current version, uses about 12 oligos, which is a lot less than the initial 56 to estimate SNP frequencies. And human genome is about 50 times more complex than this genome. So our signal-to-noise ratio is, in fact, better than human SNP chip because we can integrate so many oligos together in each transcript. Make sense? Those oligos are not typing the same SNP, right? But it doesn't really matter. For all I know, the fact that they're estimating different SNPs is better because they're independent from each other. Signals are independent from each other. So this is what overall data look like. Overall, on the chip we are using, this is next generation chip, so there are slightly more matches. Those are total oligos on the chip. 600,000 of them are actually tagging transcripts. So they're encoding regions. And by the way, in some place in computer, I have all those distributions encoding versus non-coding in different regions of the genome, whatever. So if you wanted to look at those pictures, which are quite amazing as well, I can share with you later on. But this is the number of genes covered which is 16,000 on forward, 15,000 on reverse. And this is the average number of probes per exon, which are diagnostic, that we are using in our calls, which is a good number. And again, we filter out all of those which are less than 10, just to be conservative. Nothing changes.
So what is the definition of diagnostic?
Diagnostic means that we can look at the chip and say, hey, that chip was hybridized with Teliana, when we look at that oligonucleotide. And we are not making many mistakes when we are doing it. So here is the answer for you. And after that, I will make some quiz for you as well, if you don't mind. So we analyze DNA and RNA. In DNA, we see 180 adenosine alleles retained. And we see 45 Teliana alleles retained. So the alternative alleles are deleted from SWASHiQ.
This situation where there's 180 where you only see adenosine.
That's correct. I would not be able to argue with straight case that we see only adenosine. But we see bloody good evidence that it should be adenosine. Admixture of Teliana doesn't seem to be statistically justifiable, let me put it in this way. Now, this is a picture for deletion.
Which means that out of seven probes...
No, it is not probes. It means that we will see that picture for all probes consistently within this gene. We have 10 diagnostic probes, and all of them go in the same direction, saying that this allele is deleted.
8, right?
Hmm?
8 for one species? Or I thought you had 8 diagnostic probes.
10. At least 10. Because we filter out low ones. So now, Peter, coming back to your question, there is some bias here. But what we are doing, we are actually starting this analysis from doing probe-level analysis. What is the number of probes which we see as adenosine specific and Teliana specific? And this is not biased.
Well, those adenosine specific meaning they have no signal.
That's right.
Teliana has signal.
That's right. We only see that bias when we combine a bunch of them together and when we do inferences on the basis of multiple markers per gene. Now, let's look at RNA. So, number of silenced Teliana genes is 900. So number of adenosine-like signals among transcripts where only adenosine allele is expressed, or adenosine allele is expressed substantially stronger than Teliana allele. Oh, this is for the genes in which both alleles appear to be present. So we see both of those alleles in DNA sample, right? In DNA sample, we see mix of hybridization, and we expect 50-50, right? And we compare it with actual data from F1. So SWASHiQ and the artificial F1 are no different for those guys, for those 1,200 genes. And what we see is that adenosine alleles are only found in about 1,000 of genes. Teliana alleles are only found in about 400 genes. So here's a quiz for you. Which of those organisms is sulfur and which of those organisms is outcrosser? So I had a great teacher in genetics class, not my teacher, but I see him performing, Scott Holley. When he was teaching human genetics with a couple of hundred students and he was asking a question to the audience, he just kept it silent when his answer was received. The biggest gap I've seen in his performance was about 10 minutes of silence. It was very impressive. Okay, so let me repeat the question. Who of them is sulfur and who of them is outcrosser?
Well, this is the opposite result of what you expected, right?
Why?
Why? Absolutely.
Could I get the answer first? Shamil.
Outcrosser and Leon is sulfur.
Okay, yeah, right. I think that it is kind of beautiful, actually. I'm not sure that it is explanation, well, but it is wonderful.
Well,
to some degree.
So you want to keep the genes in the outcrosser.
Well, you would think that they are healthier. They accumulate probably less deleterious variation.
Am I reading that wrong, or are we keeping more? We're keeping more genes from the sulfur.
We are keeping more genes from adenosine. Those are genes which are kept from adenosine.
Oh wait, so sorry, I'm reading deletions there.
Apologies. Yeah, these tests deletions and these tests silencing, right? Apologies. Those are alleles which are present from adenosine. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So the conclusion is that they turn the other way.
Now, so the question is, there are a couple of contingents.
Maybe I missed this. How does Sushika, is it an outcrosser or a sulfur?
Sushika is actually a sulfur, which is kind of interesting because you have strong expectations that that flowering genes should all resemble Tiliana, right? Or at least adenosine genes shall be silenced. The problem is that RNA was extracted from leaf tissues, so it's not really clear what we can say here. By the way, and we know direction of ENSHA and CROSS, chloroplast should have been from Tiliana, and this is how we classify it, which is nice internal control. So what we are doing now, we are doing a bunch of qPCRs to actually support this picture, but the picture seems to be kind of reasonable and strong enough to show it to you here. So what is interesting here? What is important, it is before we make any conclusions, what happens in F1? Because when tetraploid is formed for the first time, right, it doesn't mean that all alleles are working. Alleles are getting instantaneously silenced. What is lucky for us, it is that a couple of groups actually worked on this problem, and it appears that alleles are kind of silenced in random fashion in respect to parent of origin. And they are silenced in different ways in different offspring. So there is no consistent picture of bias towards one or another allele. So you can think of starting point as unbiased, at least tentatively. And then in Sueshika, adenosine alleles are more frequently retained and more frequently utilized. So here are a few questions which are coming along. Is silencing region specific? If you silence one allele in some particular piece of chromosome, does it mean that nearby gene that you silence a chunk of chromosome, right?
This F1 silencing refers to normal diploid or tetraploid?
Tetraploid. Apologies, yeah. Second, is silencing pathway specific? Which means the following. Suppose you have some wonderful genetic network in adenosine in which all those alleles have co-evolved with each other for 5 million years, right? Does it mean, and Tiliana alleles themselves co-evolved for 5 million years. Does it mean that now you only have working adenosine allele? Does it mean that allele which is interacting with it or gene which is interacting with it all will primarily have else adenosine allele retained? So that's another question. Or for example, another question, is silencing reflective of population genetics? For example, if you take those genes which have evidence of like selection relaxation in current Tiliana, does it mean that there will be pattern of their preferential silencing in Sueshika, right? We can try to look at tons of those questions, and in green means that we are trying to do it now, but we are not there yet. But this we have done, the first one. The problem with the third one is that data are not yet public, although they are becoming public on genetic variation in adenosine, in Tiliana, from resequencing. Whole genome resequencing of a bunch of genotypes. And for that, we don't really have good information about networks. We don't know what to use because Go annotations are no help and other networks are kind of strange. But for the first one, I do have some picture to show you. So how we express our allele-specific bias. It is bias a fraction of transcript which comes from one allele in comparison with another, right? So this is what we plot here in the windows of 50 genes, right? So this is, if alleles are unbiased, our parameter is zero. If one allele is expressed, Ayanoza allele, it is one. If Taliana allele is expressed, it is minus one. So, for example, this is local window in which bunch of genes are silenced in respect to parent of origin, or this is another one. And permutations are running right now to understand which of those are actually significant clumping of features, of genes.
What is the red?
Gosh, what is red? Don't remember. One of them is DNA and another of them is RNA. So DNA shows deletions.
Yeah. I guess the red would be the DNA.
I don't remember. I think that it is correct, but yeah, that was done like 2 days ago.
So I want to.
Uh huh.
As an alternative way of thinking about this, because you posed it as the question of, you know, smashing together a silver and an outcrosser genome and seeing which survives better. The tetraploid hybrid, it perhaps is just all ecological.
The first
story you told us, you came up with a couple of hundred genes just to a little aspect of habitat. So behind so is in more of a.
I 100% agree. To some degree, it is golden mine, because what you can ask questions like it is the following. Okay, let me now sample Sueshika from some location where it lives close by Taliana and some location where it is adapted to Arenosa-like environments, right? One of them is more northern and another is more southern. Will you see preferential silencing in accordance with ecology, right? Or, for example, you resequence that crop and then you actually do population generic analysis at allele-specific level, right? Contrasting selection coefficients on those sequences which are coming from one or from another. And sequence divergence is good enough to detect tons of gene conversions, you name it, whatever. It's very rich evolutionary story, and what I'm showing is just like the first step. It's amusing that there was only one study in cotton for whole genome analysis of what is happening in tetraploids. And nobody knows it because it was published in Crop Science. Right. Uh-huh.
So can you give an answer to the quiz? You know, how are we supposed to deduce from the fact that the Arenosa genes are...
I'm no population geneticist. Ask population geneticists here.
Oh.
Right. If you have tons of alleles of very small effects, right, and you have sulfur, they are not efficiently removed from population.
Sulfur, first of all, presumably is cleaned of recessive lethals.
That's right. So, and then everything depends on what is your idea about what is more important. Tons of weak mutations or smaller number of large effect mutations which are partially recessive. And if you believe in one scenario, you expect sulfur.
I didn't even dream of that. I would have thought that selfing lifestyle is good in a stable environment,
right.
And if you're doing well in a stable environment, you self.
Mm.
If you live in a variable environment and you can't predict the future, you might be better off taking chances and crossing. But so and so generically, so not as a population geneticist, but as a game theorist.
Okay.
If you're doing well yourself, if you're doing badly, you cross.
You are formulating exactly that question that was asked here, right? What is better? And this is why I formulated that question is like that, right? Is outcrosser better than sulfur, right?
No, I'm happy with being given that.
Okay,
answer.
Wonderful. let me just defend logical point, right? instead of arguing, you can make, you can let evolution to do experiment. So evolution has made perfect experiment for you. It took whole genome, it put those four alleles together, and it make those alleles competing with each other. So you see outcome.
I wouldn't say perfect experiment.
Okay, imperfect experiment.
Okay.
But Peter, admit that 30,000 years of evolution is damn good enough. It is more than what an NIH can support for us for, right?
So is it known that the formation of Sueshika
happened once?
Happened once. Yes.
Yes, it is known.
And how do they know that?
Because it traces to the same four alleles.
Okay.
And you had mentioned some of them living near Arenosa versus Aliana. Is there kind of a general sense of in what whose ecology they share more? I mean, if we think that a lot of these things are actually driven by ecological pressures rather than kind of all else being equal, is it better to be a self or an outcross?
No, those populations were co-sampled in same, like in broadly the same locations, but there is variation of geographic distribution. So in principle, we could have done it. But again, this is one out of 20 projects, right? I really don't know which of those projects are kind of more interesting to go forward on and which are not. For example, here, resequencing would be a golden mine, right? The problem is it reasonable to attempt to do this resequencing when we have like 35 base chunks, or shall we engage in it when we have like 75 as paired end reads? And I think that 75 as paired end reads would be probably good enough for this level of divergence to actually construct, to actually assemble both genomes semi-independently from each other. But this is not a trivial issue, right?
Let me just ask one more question.
Uh-huh.
Because, first of all, Aliana sort of acquired itself in, sometimes during its history. So it has been a self for its entire species.
That's right, yeah.
And that's known. And it's also, and there also is a little bit of recombination, so that the, you know, LD decays over maybe 30-50 kb.
That's right, yeah.
And in addition, it's fairly polymorphic.
Mm-hmm.
How polymorphic is Arenosa?
I have no clue.
Because
that's
one of the kind of knee-jerk, you know, responses that a population makes. Well, sulfurs sometimes are have very restricted habitats or something like that. Come in small populations, and then you may get a lot more fixation of accumulation. But Thaliana is itself with some recombination and quite a bit of polymorphism.
Okay, shall we make a break now, or shall I start speaking about Drosophila right away?
No, let's take a break.
Okay. Yes, I'm entitled to make one remark about this data. It is that if we wanted to compare evolutionary history of Arenosa-originated and Thaliana-originated alleles, our inferences would not be confounded with the differences in demographic history, right? Which is like a contrast to pretty much all the talks that were done here before. Okay, so let me now move to Drosophila. And because most of people here are speaking about humans, I want to justify Drosophila and its phenotypes for you. Drosophila is just like humans. So see, they sing to each other, they use perfumes, they fall in love, they dance to each other. And you can actually see their phenotypes and you can see their difference. Differences, for example, you can see that this is a female, as you can see by the lipstick she is using, right? And this is a male, and what I would like to point your attention to, it is that in the process of their interactions, what is kind of important for them is that the back of their body is not the same between males and females. In males, it is much darker, and in females, it is lighter. And what is the reason for that? It's not really exactly understood, especially in relation to how their vision works and how they perceive each other in the process of mating. But this is what I'm going to focus on quantitative genetics of those interesting things, of those pigmentation patterns between males and females. By the way, once I've heard wonderful question and response at evolution meeting, when at Drosophila meeting, when genome of Drosophila was released for the first time, there was advertisement by whomever describing how wonderful Drosophila is a model system for humans and whatever, and somebody from the audience asked that Drosophila is not perfect model for humans because Drosophila has wings and humans don't. So the response was that Drosophila is actually not a model for human, but it is model for angels, right? So this is what I'm going to be speaking about here, I guess. So this is that phenotype. And what we have done with our angels, we cut their back. So imagine that initially it was shaped like that, right? And we cut it on the back, and then we unfolded it, right? And this is what you see. This is like abdomen vision of like model for studying human angels. And this is male. And what I pointed for you as the difference in pigmentation between males and females is shown quite clearly here. This is a couple of last segments which are very dark in melanogaster. And females are not as dark, and their segment structure is slightly different from each other, from males and females. But what is typical for females is that some females are strong pigmented, and some females are weakly pigmented in this area. And it might sound like not a very interesting character. Why it was interesting for us, it is that clearly they use that to discriminate between each other. And there are somewhat controversial evidences for that, but some uncontroversial it seems to be. And these differences in pigmentation between males and females are understood to be as a result of reasonably recent evolution, about 20 million years ago, of transcriptional regulation of Bric-a-brac locus. So Bric-a-brac locus is complex locus, so it has a couple of genes, Bric-a-brac 1, Bric-a-brac 2, and they are partially functionally redundant, not completely. But the locus is huge. It has 150,000 bases. And why this locus is important for us, it is that we have made some years ago QTL mapping experiment. We made our recombinant inbred lines from two heterozygote flies sampled from nature. So as a result of that, our recombinant inbred lines were kind of unusual because they segregated for up to four alleles in the locus, while usually recombinant inbred lines segregate for just two alleles in the locus. So we were able to estimate effects of four alleles independently from each other, three independently from each other. And we were able to polarize effect in respect with allele frequencies and do quite interesting things in relation to that. But in the case, so we studied tons of different characters, and what was cute about pigmentation pattern, it is that one piece of third chromosome accounted for 60% of variation in pigmentation. So that was huge. So our recombinant inbred lines, as I mentioned, were started from four alleles, which I imaginably depicted here as red, green, blue, and yellow. And if we take all our recombinant inbred lines and they separately plot the distribution of trait value among red alleles, so I take subset of recombinant inbred lines which have red alleles for that tip of third chromosome, I take subset of recombinant inbred lines for green allele, for blue and for yellow, and I plot their distributions, you will see that in fact it is allele of major effect, right? So green allele means that you are pigmented. Those recombinant inbred lines which had green allele were all dark for females. Red allele means that you are not very pigmented. Your pigmentation score is about 80%. And they're actually very different from each other. So this was a bit exciting because this is where Bric-a-brac is situated. It is positioned on the end of third chromosome. And by the way, you were speaking a ton about Hill-Robertson effect, right? So this is clearly Robertson effect. And this, the reason for this statement is the following, that Robertson in end 50s or beginning of 60s, I don't remember exactly when, published a paper that if you take a bunch of ends of third chromosome, and it is the same Robertson, and you introgress them in common background, there will be tons of variation for pigmentation between different flies, which is attributed to single locus. So I don't quite have Hill effect here, but at least there is Robertson. So there is very good evidence that a bunch of Drosophila populations do segregate for pigmentation, and that that particular region of chromosome accounts for most of that. And by the way, this is kind of boring part of presentation, but I included here because it is only one piece out of four which actually matches the title of my talk that was invented by Marty. So I felt obligation to be conforming at least on somewhat. So in any case, so what we have done, we took large effect mutation of Bric-a-brac and we did complementation test. And what does it mean, complementation test, which is, I think that complementation test in quantitative genetics should be registered as like cuss word. So in general, it should not be trusted, but you can trust this data for the following reason, that we did it not with parental lines, not with single recombinant inbred line, but we did it with bunch of recombinant inbred lines. So interlocus interactions, which are supposedly tested by complementation test and which are usually confounded with intralocus interactions, at least partially I counted here, because we have taken bunch of lines for green allele and bunch of lines for red allele, and we use them in the test. So what is the test? Because most of you here are not quantitative geneticists, I will engage in explanation. So suppose you believe that you have one allele and another allele in some gene, and you want to understand whether or not that QTL is allelic to some known mutation. And suppose you have this known mutation in heterozygote against some standard chromosome, for example, balancer chromosome. Bric-a-brac is homozygote little, so it has to be kept as heterozygote. And it is homozygote little because it is involved in fertility of flies. It is engaged in germline pathway in females. So what you do? You, out of that, generate individuals with four combinations. You have QTL1 heterozygote with Bric-a-brac. This is one of your genotypes. You have QTL2, which stands for alleles in the same QTL, apologies. You have second allele of that QTL against Bric-a-brac. And this is null. So in a sense, you have your allele as hemizygote. So the difference between effect of those two alleles in your QTL locus shall be fully expressed. Now, you compare this with the following heterozygotes, QTL1 versus balancer, which has wild-type allele of your gene, and second allele in QTL against balancer. And now, in those two genotypes, QTL allele is in heterozygous combination, so its effect is not fully expressed. So you expect to see smaller differences here than you see there, right? This is what is called quantitative complementation test. The problem is that usually balancer and usually all of that has different backgrounds. So if you see that picture, it might as well be explained by interlocus interactions. This is why we took a bunch of recombinant inbred lines. And this is a contrast between Bric-a-brac and balancer allele for green. and you see that for green allele is basically dominant, right? Because those two are not consistently different from each other, those two score, again, across 10 recombinant inbred lines with different backgrounds that we were using. And red allele is recessive. So clearly there is generic interaction between red allele and Bricabrac locus, and they are different from green locus, which basically is an evidence that Bricabrac, that our QTLs, which account for 60% of variation in bristle number, are allelic to Bricabrac. This is one of the best pieces of evidence I know. Again, all of that is consistent cross-background, which is simple to do with easy ANOVA models. Now, what is Bricabrac again? What have we done? 60% of variation attributed to single locus is a good case for association studies. I'm not familiar with too many cases better than that. So we, under that pretense, we got a bunch of money from NSF to resequence stuff. And we successfully resequenced full alleles from 100 lines, which is not too much of accomplishment nowadays. But again, this is 100 alleles, each of which is resequenced for consistent 150,000 bases, for which we have generic variation and we have phenotypic variation data. And just as a remark to human people, if some of you are doing genome-wide association studies in humans, what is very different in Drosophila in comparison with humans? It is that the extent of linkage disequilibrium in Drosophila is deep, right? Average window of LD is about 200 bases. So we don't really have haplotype blocks, right? We have pretty much semi-independent SNP to character associations. SNPs are basically segregating independently from each other. Not completely independently, thank God. And realistically, what it looks like, it is that the average SNP density is about 50 bases in our case. Average LD scale is about 200 bases, right? So pretty much in every case, suppose you are modeling it for modeling association, you are doing what you are doing. You take your lines out of 100 sequence strains with one allele, with another allele, right? And you compare their pigmentation as two groups. And if you see significant differences between them, you say that that SNP is associated with pigmentation. Make sense? So that's as simple as that, and you can use tons of different tests for that. But realistically, what might be a slightly more sophisticated version for that, it is that we resequence everything. So we are not really doing association, we are doing causal inference, right? This SNP might be causing bristle number differences. But then there are SNPs close by at some distance, which should be at smaller linkage disequilibrium, at smaller association with bristle number. Because linkage disequilibrium between those SNPs and the SNP which is causing bristle number differences are decaying with LD scale, right? So what we can do for our association is actually integrate a few SNPs together, fit in that model of lesser association for close by SNPs, where one shows the highest association and close by SNPs show slightly lesser association depending on their distance. So this is what we are doing. We are taking this expected picture of association and we are moving it along the window and we are fitting that model to try to understand what is the probability that given SNP is causing bristle is causing pigmentation variation in our population.
So what you're describing, and I understand that your effect is very large and you're only resequencing a piece of the genome, but this sounds like a terrible scenario for doing an association study because you have each 50 base pair you have a SNP and your LD block is very short, meaning your bonferroni or any whatever multiple test correction you're using should be very severe. right? That in this picture, you generally, at least what I think people see in human data, it's not guaranteed that the highest p-value, the causal variant would have highest p-value. So on top of this multiple test correction, you should do pairwise conditional test.
No. That actually is not important. We are slightly increasing our power by integrating information from several SNPs at a time. So it doesn't really matter, right? You just fit multiple SNPs instead of single SNP. It doesn't affect your degrees of freedom, nothing, right? In terms of whether or not it is terrible or not terrible, that depends on your goals, right? What is terrible? It is that with humans, identifying causal SNP is impossible, at least without follow-up experiments. I would say that it is horrible, right? You have higher power of detecting association, but then you need to swear to pray to your local human gut to try to understand what it is, right? Here you have less probability of detecting association, but if you detect it, you know what it is. So it's a very different scenario. In terms of huge effect, 60%, this is actually good for us, right? Because we are not dealing with a bunch of statistical artifacts. Uh-huh.
Sergey, what populations did you survey? And did you say it was 1,000 lines?
It is just 100 lines. 100. And it is a single local population from Winters.
California,
right. Mm-hmm. We have some evidence for slight population stratification between sampling types times, but not huge.
So what is the vertical axis?
This is some proxy for allele frequencies, don't remember. Sorry, it's just like to show you the structure of the locus, segregating SNPs and the scale of LD. Doesn't really matter. What matters is that picture. This is associations in accordance with that model. And there is no p-values here. It is because they are difficult to assign. But let me put it in this way. The best peak has FDR of about 0.1. So the best guy, this one, has FDR about, oh yeah, and of course we have done population genetics of that region, and there are regions under balancing selection, there are regions under, like, we show some evidence for directional selection, whatever, you name it. And all of that is not connected to functional elements in any sensible way, so it's altogether a different story, but FDR, the best is 0.1. Now, if you try to understand, so this is effects of individual SNPs, right, after you account for segregation of SNPs close by. And if you take about 30 SNPs, and for each of our recombinant inbred line, you just count, okay, this particular, sorry, not recombinant, but isogenic line. You count all the SNPs, how they shall bias pigmentation score in plus and minus direction, right? Because we have effects associated with those given SNPs. So if you take about 30 top SNPs or 40 top SNPs, they account for 60% of variation. So this is it. This is as much as we understand. Now, another piece of data. As Shamil correctly pointed, after Bonferroni correction, nothing will ever be significant, right? And this is damn clear, and it will be the same problem with human resequencing data. So you can think about this as a case study for future, right? Nothing is significant.
Is that how you sold it?
Actually, we got money about 4 years ago, and all this data set was produced about 2 years ago. And since that time, we tried to understand how to do analysis in a sensible way. So, but what is kind of cute, and I don't know, I want to check this logic with you, what we have tried to do to understand what matters and what not. So suppose we do permutations, and we record in permutations the highest peak on permuted data, the second highest peak on permuted data, the third one permuted data, right? And we go down below to say 50. Make sense? So then we take our actual score and we compare it with those first, second highest, third highest, tenth highest, 50th best association from permuted data set. So of course for the first, let me plot p-value here from like 0 to 1. And here's the number of those peaks.
What are you actually permuting?
We are permuting phenotypes. Right? And let me plot here something like 50. Right? So this is our permuted scores. Where the first permuted score, of course, so those are chance values, if you wish, right? Where the first permuted has the highest probability, and the second, third, etc., 50th have lower probability. Make sense? And this is our actual p-values. So this is how it looks like. So when we have about 40 SNPs, what I would claim is that what this picture shows, and I'm sorry, I didn't quite have picture to splash here, but if you want it, I can send it under request or have it with me tomorrow. It is that our biggest value, biggest association, doesn't have enough information in itself to claim that it is significant. Our 10 are not significantly enriched. But when we sum information, this is my positive interpretation, optimistic interpretation. But when we add 40, the highest of associations, we know that they are significantly enriched for those which are associated with pigmentation score.
Do we claim we have 10 independent effects here?
That's a good question. I think that we have, that this is what we have, 10 or 20 or 30 or 40. And this is the problem. And this is why I wanted to show you this data. Because on one side, we have very optimistic scenario, 60% of variation, clearly understood biologically gene, right? Unquestionable candidate. Everything is resequenced. Sample size is sufficient for 60% of variation, if we assume that there are few SNPs of reasonable effect. Are there a few SNPs of reasonable effect? No. There are... might be 40 SNPs, or at least 20 SNPs, which account for that variation. And I can say to you which of those are 40 candidates enriched for those which are affected in pigmentation. But this is all I can conclude from that.
But your deep work is 200, right? So it should be roughly 10. It cannot be all 40. So some of that is all deep.
I have 150,000 bases here, right? So I have 750 independent windows, right? So all of those are independent, of course. So that's it. That's my description of where we arrived. And I suspect that this is realistic picture rather than wishful thinking picture, which will be encountered in multiple cases. This is why I wanted to share it with you.
And the situation actually may be worse than that, right? In the sense, based on...
Yeah, this is the best case scenario, if you wish.
Well, also, that if you were to now repeat this in another population, you'll find the Brickerback locus accounting for 60%, but you'll get a completely different set of peaks. That's my prediction.
Probably. Uh-huh.
But sort of you're doing right now is that there's the largest number of small effect, whatever. But it could also be that there's, you know, that most of these things have no effect whatsoever. But there's a bunch of things in there that sort of produce some very rugged interacting phenotype. That all these other things are just labeling these different...
Yep. As I mentioned, I represented optimistic interpretation of the data. If you start speaking about interaction terms here, that becomes a bit of a bit more of an issue.
Could be attached with another 5%.
Right.
It gives us 32 different.
Oh yeah, just to give you some information, it is some here, some place here. So we have about 6,000 SNPs segregated in that population, 900 indels, right? So it is 40 SNPs or 6 indels per KB. So you can envision how many pairwise interaction terms or triway interaction terms we could have here. Right. So here is the story. Now, the question is how to go forward from here. And of course, we can like take those 40 SNPs, and this is what we are doing, because they seemed, actually, I would appreciate your feedback about this logic. Is it right logic or not? On one side, it is good that we are not basing our conclusion on outliers, because basing conclusions on outliers is always scary. We are basing our conclusions on that part of the distribution which is no longer outlier. On another sense, I'm not sure that it is right interpretation, and those people who thought about populations much more than I did, I would appreciate some comments about it. Uh-huh.
So one question is, if there are interactions and those effects are not independent and they are multiple, so you would think that given that this is one locus and some of them will be reasonably close to each other, it can be that there is epistatic selection. And this then would result in extended LD. So I don't know if your LD picture, you have any suggestions that things which are not 200 base pairs but are KB.
No obvious cases of extended LD.
I have a silly question. You mentioned earlier that it's not easy to get p-values. So first, I'm not sure why, and second, I'm not sure how you get an FDR rate without getting p-values.
Oh, we have p-values. It's just not clear to understand what they mean by how many independent tests you correct them and all this stuff, right? Yeah, sure. You can have whatever you wish. So, so this is what we are doing. We are taking those 40 and we are using them in population size, with population size SNP typing of about 1,000 individuals, probably we will understand something, or maybe we will not. So as Tony Lone was saying, that if you get finally to the sample size of 100,000 or 1 million of genotypes, which is equivalent to population size of Drosophila, and you don't see association, it is not there. So with that optimistic logic, we can go forward and try to understand what is going on, but this is current state of affairs. And the only stuff that we are trying to add here, it is, or where hope might be, it is actually to try to understand how it works. And might be add functional information here. For example, we know when bric-a-brac expressed in what patterns, bric-a-brac 1, bric-a-brac 2, during development of those disks, of those imaginal disks, which will then result in formation of those tissues, and maybe we can try to add somehow functional information to our purely statistical information in this sense. So I will show you some attempts of, we are not there with this system, but I will show you some attempts where we are trying to do it with other system and think together with you whether or not it works. But again, I will appreciate very much all advice on those association studies and on what we can or cannot conclude. Peter, you?
Well, I mean, could we go back to what is the evidence that bric-a-brac is where you should be looking again? Just like in a nutshell.
So, this is complementation test, right? So this picture, for example, green, is showing is the evidence of a lack of complementation by bric-a-brac allele and QTL, right? If you attempt to complement null of bric-a-brac with natural allele, it doesn't rescue it. It doesn't rescue phenotype.
It's like another locus in that genome somehow. Because you're doing your association study, not in these lines. Like if you had done your resequenced these, presumably something would come out, right?
First, when Robertson studied his population from Scotland and he saw those pictures, it is different population and still effect mapped to the same piece of chromosome. So that's a good evidence that it is consistent cross populations at least. Then pigmentation pathway is reasonably well understood and it is simple. And the reason for that, it is that it is new pathway. It originated reasonably recently. And we understand tons about how pigment is produced, but it has nothing to do with the production of pigment. Intensities of those stripes are absolutely the same. And this is a full pathway which leads to those stripes. We don't know much downstream of that pathway of bric-a-brac after yellow. But
that's not the full pathway.
It's a full upstream pathway, which kind of matters for do it in sex-specific way between males and females. This is where the signal is integrated.
Yes. Yeah, okay, so that part of...
That's
that
right, of yes. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, you don't have many choices.
Mm-hmm. And the mapping is to that. Again, we know that it is sexually dimorphic at this stage. Okay, so again, it's as good as it gets. It is not good enough, right? But at least it is honest statement. Okay, so let me go to the last portion. And I actually can shut up here, or I can go on for hours and hours and show you different pictures. I plan to give you another portion with some ideas and some pictures, if you wanted to, which is how variation in pathways scales into phenotypic variation. And I will give you a general description about transcriptome variation, for starters. And then I will focus on insulin receptor TOR pathway in flies and how it is connected with downstream phenotypes. So this is where the data I will be speaking about are coming from. At some point, we decided that we wanted to do an allele-specific array with Agilent. So we came to gene annotations and we selected all features for splicing variants and blah, blah, blah. And I am showing you the data which we obtained with that custom 60 base array for 10,000 genes, which have no multiple splicing variants. So that will be simple limited analysis. And we want to understand basic quantitative genetics of transcriptome. So we think about transcript level as about quantitative trait, and we are doing standard quantitative genetic decomposition of transcript level of a gene to general combining ability, specific combining ability, reciprocal general combining ability, reciprocal specific combining ability, and error term. And for those of you who don't keep this information on top of their head, this is what those are. So we have taken 9 genotypes of flies, originating from exactly the same population as previous, for which we actually have tons of other information. And we cross them in full diallele design. So those are SARS and DEMS. And what is general combining ability? So we measure everything in heterozygotes of both sexes, males and females, transcript levels of those 10,000 single splice genes. So what is general combining ability? So you have overall transcript level for a given gene, average for this table, right? Let me now take all the cells in which you see 3, which depicts origin of that haplotype from isogenic line number 3, right? Consistent deviation of those guys who have 3 from population mean is called general combining ability. This is equivalent of additive genetic variation, if you wish, right? No matter what genotype 3 is combined to, it is causing deviation from population mean. And no matter is a statement about additivity of the effects, right? Now, what is reciprocal general combining ability? You compare that with that. Parent of origin of allele 3. This is what a reciprocal combining ability is. Now, suppose I have this general combinability for genotype 3 and for genotype 5, right? So my deviation in that genotype, which has 5-3 or 3-5, should be a sum of those deviations, right? I know deviation for 3 from population mean. I know deviation for 5 from population mean. If they are additive, they shall add. That's the definition of additivity. If they don't, whatever is remaining is called specific combinability, which is equivalent of dominance variation, right? Now, just to understand whether or not I lost you and how successfully, let me ask you, what is reciprocal specific combinability? Difference between which two cells do you think it is? Any hints? This is between Z blue and Z blue, right? So this is reciprocal specific combinability. So we have our 72 cells because we excluded homozygotes, because there is no homozygote flies in nature, who cares for them? And we have males and females emerging from the same vials, whatever, that we sample for RNA extractions. Now, this is our partitioning of data.
And the assumption is that male and female coming from the same vial have the same genotype?
It is not assumption. This is what we know, right? Because we cross specific parents, we produced F1 individuals, and those F1 individuals, when we see flies emerging from a vial, they come in two sexes. Some of them are males and some of them are females. So we separate them for RNA extractions.
There is no population diversity in the vial?
No. Okay. It is cross of two homozygous lines, okay. Right? Okay, so we detected genetic variation in all the table for so many genes, and more for females than for males, but this is where it becomes skewed. Look for general combinability. This is additive effects. There are tons of additive effects in males on X chromosome and on autosome, but not in females. In females, variation is much smaller. So males are predominantly additive, simple, linear. That's a conclusion. Look at specific combinability now. Nothing. In males, tons in females. And I always suspected that females are unpredictable and complex. And now I understand why. Because their transcriptome is highly non-additive. It is all from dominance terms. It's all from interaction terms, right? Impossible to predict. So this is as nice a contrast as it gets, and probably the reason for that, as Bill Rice would explain to you if he was in this room, is that sexually antagonistic alleles segregating on X chromosome are maintained by natural selection. And we can go into that if you wish, but it is not primarily topic here. And you can see that those guys which are maintained variant for females, for transcriptome on X chromosome, are very much enriched in comparison with the number of genes variant on autosomes. If you compare those two numbers, a chi-square test, with all the genes showing genetic variation or all the genes expected to vary. So X is severely enriched in females for non-additive effects in comparison with autosomes, which might be explained by sexual antagonism. Again, if we want to go into details of the argument, I can go into that now, but what I'm doing here, I'm showing you the data for the follow-up analysis. And the same is seen for reciprocal effects. You can see all those contrasts. And by the way, all those males and females are emerging from the same vial, so it is not connected with environmental heterogeneity or anything, and it is all replicated four times, so it's real. And we are very anal about normalizations and about everything. But this issue aside, what I want to understand it is how that transcript level variation is shaped with in pathway framework. So what I showed you is a picture of natural variation in transcriptome. And I want to understand whether or not genetic networks, as molecular biologists understand them, help us to explain how genetic variation is shaped. And there are a bunch of people who were involved, who are involved in this enterprise. To name some, it is like Leonia Krugliak, Eric Schad, and a bunch of others. Their designs are slightly different, and I think you will see why it leads to the difference in conclusions and in the pictures that we observe. So we wanted to understand or to see some pathway, whatever pathway. So we like browsed through a few papers and we decided to go for that pathway, which is insulin TOR pathway. Why it is cute? It is pathway which is generally present and working in semi-cell independent fashion in every cell of the organism. So the fact that we extract RNA from everything doesn't really matter because pathway functions broadly the same. It's internal cell pathway. It functions slightly different between muscle tissues and fat tissues, but that aside. So what we want to understand, this pathway is understood by molecular biologists. What does it mean? It means that if you knock out FOXA gene, you will see huge effects in all downstream cascade of FOXA, right? So our first question is, will we see the same effects, for example, not in knockouts of that gene, but in partial, in those genotypes which express it at lower level? Will we recapitulate the same structure of the pathway for natural variation, which is detected with major effect mutations? Second, we know what phenotypes are affected by this pathway. This is body size, lifespan, oxidative response, you name it. It's general energy processing and split into sub-pathways cascade. So what we wanted to understand it is for each of those cells which I described you previously, for all of those 70 some genotypes, heterozygotes, we have measurements of tons of phenotypes, which shall be explained by genetic variation in this pathway. Will we see it? So this is how it looks like. So that pathway was from single paper by Tillman and somebody else, which was published about half a year ago. And after we browsed through those papers, through all the papers we could envision, which were in our possession, it turned out that pathway is in fact a little bit more complex, and I rechecked it after reading tons of papers with primary people involved with that pathway, and they're saying that there are not too many mistakes here, which is a very encouraging statement. So insulin receptor signals to CHICA, then through bunch of different phosphorylation factors, PI3K, PTEN, PDK, AKT, whatever, they affect FOXA. FOXA is transcription factor. So this is insulin-like peptides which are signaling through this branch of pathway. Then there is another energy part of the pathway which assess amino acids through the receptor which is sitting on the membrane, which is called SlimFast, which then suppresses TSC genes 1 and 2. Then there is this branch of pathway, and they all converge happily on huge interaction group between FOXA, TOR, MYC, and 4-EBP to then regulate ribosome biosynthesis and to suppress or enhance translation initiation. So this is general pathway, and we have our table with a bunch of levels of transcripts. So let's try to understand how those guys are correlated with each other in males and females. And I depict data for males imaginatively in blue color, for females imaginatively in red color, and those are correlation coefficients, and whatever you see here is depicted as correlation coefficient is significant. I did not do multiple corrections here because it is all a priori expected. All of those connections are a priori expected. So here is a picture for you. Everything is correlated with everything.
So what is the correlation correction? What is the
correlation? I have 72 genotypes. In reality, not all of them are independent, but this is another issue. So if in some genotype PDK1 is upregulated, this correlation coefficient 0.92, AKT is also upregulated.
So this is phenotypic correlation.
That's right. This is not phenotypic, it is generic correlations.
But you measure it on the level of phenotypes.
Expression is a phenotype here.
But correlation is given to you at the level of generic correlation rather than phenotypic correlation, which means that all effects of environmental variation that would feed into correlations are extracted from the data. I can go on into the difference between generic correlations and phenotypic correlations, but it is a separate issue. Shamil.
There's one very curious thing in the picture, and maybe we can explain it. So we have FOX as a transcription factor, MEGA's transcription factor, right?
Right.
You have very small correlation coefficients for actually where you expect them at transcriptional level. Then you have other interactions, which would be, say, post-correlation events and other things where you see my strong interactions.
Great question. Beats me why? Do you have any idea?
There's no. Mm-hmm.
Okay. These correlations are all positive.
They're expected to be positive. Well, some of them are expected to be positive. Some are expected to be negative.
This looks as if sort of there is some zero mode, so something that everything is up or down together. So wouldn't it maybe appropriate to look then for the excess on top of that?
How?
But I don't know. But
I don't know either. This is why I'm showing it to you to maybe brainstorm together with you. Okay. So I have this pathway. I know a priori structure of that pathway. I know tons of data about transcript levels. How do I put it together?
But this is a signaling pathway. So
this is a signaling pathway, exactly.
So for example, activation of insulin mm-hmm. receptor doesn't necessarily control expression of Chico, right?
That's right. But you can have a different argument. For example, suppose you have all those phosphorylation guys, right? So there is whole sense for cell to produce them in the same equimolar concentrations to optimize signal transduction. I do not know.
Yeah. Okay, but you don't really expect the correlation on the level of expression from the fact that one is above the other.
You are 100% correct. This is why I'm showing it to you as a little bit controversial. This is what we see, right? And we see it consistently in males and females. And basically, my statement from that is that probably if we had those correlation coefficients, there is no way in hell we could have resolved the structure of this pathway from them. Mm-hmm. And we can do structural equations or Bayesian inference, but probably not.
So the typical picture, like embedded to us in molecular biology classes, is that you keep roughly constant concentration of FOX RNA and the FOX is switched on or off by phosphorylation events.
By phosphorylation, by PKB or AKT.
Right.
How this suppression is looking, just for a sec. So if you have AKT active, right, it phosphorylates FOXA. Phosphorylated FOXA gets pulled out of nucleus, right, and then it cannot act as transcriptional factor. This is what happens.
Right, so you should not expect even correlation between FOX RNA level and levels of AKT or PDK1.
Shamil, 0.98 sounds bloody damn convincing, isn't it?
But he asked a different question. He didn't ask...
I'm not asking question here. I'm just showing it to you, right?
He said,
give it a take.
Would you just expect on the basis of the fact that one phosphorylates the other, the fact that the levels of expression are correlated? And the answer is, I don't think we can really claim to understand why that is high and the one below is low.
Now, just to give you some piece of information which is not shown here, and for which I unfortunately didn't have with me good enough pictures. So what is known, it is that if you don't feed flies for a couple of days, then 3,000-5,000 genes are changing in transcript level. Or if you do FOXA knockout or partial knockout, it affects 1,000 genes downstream. Or if you feed flies with ripamycin, which is blocking TOR, then 1,200 genes are affected, right? So let me just give you like one piece of information, that if you take those 1,000 genes, right, and you calculate correlation coefficient between them, the median correlation coefficient in a group of 1,000 genes is 0.8, which is slightly significantly different from zero. And they're all co-regulated. And they all are covariant with along single dimension, no multiple dimension. So
is there a master regulator of the pathway?
I have no clue what it means. I am so desperate that I am ready to subscribe to the notion of Ralph Greenspan that everything is connected with everything. The question is why other groups don't see it? And let me just contrast you this data set with what other groups are doing and trying to see whether or not trans... By the way, this is not our original observation. There are tons of published papers, a few published papers, in which people express strong surprise that when they look at metabolic pathway, transcript levels corresponding to that metabolic pathway are covariant across genotypes. And most of that is, again, coming from plant breeders literature, who are very serious about those issues, because not only they want to get like select corn, but they want to select corn with appropriate angle of leaves for given environment, which is optimizing sun intake versus evaporation. So they're like using serious genetic engineering construction approaches, and they analyze metabolome in a quite serious way, and they see it as well. Now, why other groups don't quite see the same picture of everything connected with everything? It is for the following, perhaps, reason. For example, let me allude to papers by Eric Stadt. What they analyze? They analyze a set of recombinant inbred lines which are generated from two parents. Right? What does it mean? Suppose I generate population of 200 lines and I score transcript levels in all of them. And I'm interested in the question of whether or not SlimFast is correlated with TSC. There are only two alleles. What is the likelihood that those two alleles are functionally the same? Quite high, right? So they will see lack of that connection, perhaps. Right? Because there are only two segregating alleles, and for all I know, they might be the same. So they're starting, all of them, and Krugliak and Stadt, they're starting from situations with very depuperate genetic variation. All of them start from two genotypes. So what they see? Do they see all pathways and their complexity, or they see short traces and few connections from analysis of a couple of genotypes? I would claim that they see only few connections. And this is why their pathways look sparse. Not because they are sparse, but because they don't deal with genetic variation in any reasonable way. So that would be my claim for the difference.
But so these aren't partial correlations, right?
Those are not partial correlations, that's right.
Can't that explain part of it? So FOXO is always down and TOR is high.
Yep, good, yeah. Yeah, we played with structural equations with bits and pieces, and basically the same. Okay, so now that was the first question. At superficial level, the presence of all those huge correlations implies that genetic variation is probably shaped with that pathway. It's even more shaped than we would expect. But then there are phenotypic data. For example, desiccation, oxidation, starvation resistance, longevity, development time, body size, and other correlations. You bet there are. For example, FOXA transcript level is associated with oxidative resistance as minus 0.93 with decent significance, even after multiple testing correction. And this is what FOXA is expected to do. If you knock out, desiccation resistance goes way up. By the way, this is not positive correlation. Some correlations are negative. And it is sparse, but there are more correlations that we expect by chance. So there is phenotypic variation is explained by variation in the pathway, But because parsley seems to be so well connected with each other, I would be hard-pressed to understand which stage of the parsley accounts for what phenotypic variation here. The question, what to do about it? Any questions, comments, concerns? This is not very well thought about piece of data, so I'm kind of sharing you with you as we go along with analysis and understanding what to do here. So what we think might be interesting to try to do, and probably we will go for doing it, is the following. That actually all those transcript level alterations which you saw in that table of generic variation for transcript level, which I showed you, are actually coming in two sorts, cis and trans. There are some mutations which are affecting transcript levels. And say those mutations in the genes which are affected themselves in transcript levels then signal downstream to modify expression of some other guys below them, right? So I would claim that cis mutation is a statement about a mutation which is affecting transcript level of that gene in which it happened. Trans effect mutation, it is a guy which is affected by somebody else. And we know well approaches of how to take all transcriptome and sort mutations to cis and trans. For example, the simplest example for you, you take two homozygotes which are different for expression between two genes, between one gene. For example, this low, this high. You make heterozygote from them. If trans effects were responsible for the differences between them, you would see the same level of expression in heterozygote, right? If cis differences are responsible for difference in transcript level between them, those alleles in heterozygote would still express at the same level. So you can take your homozygote and say, okay, this homozygote has 200 cis mutations which are affecting transcript levels of self, and downstream it affects transcript levels of 1,000 genes. Right? This is for one of your homozygotes. You can take the same for the second homozygote, for the third homozygote, for all the genotypes. This is what is schematically depicted here. Those are cis mutations, pink guys, within genotype. This is my idealistic representation of network where not everything is connected with everything, but at least something is connected to something. And those depict trans effects of mutations in other genes on transcript level of those guys downstream. Now, suppose I want to reconstruct those connections of what is affecting what. If I now have cis mutations and trans mutations, suddenly I am working in slightly different, with slightly different scenario. Why? Because I have causes and consequences, right? And they have them separated from each other. So for each genotype, I know what mutations are affecting transcript levels in those genotypes. And I know what is affected. Now, the question is, how many genotypes would I need to reconstruct all possible connections at transcript level? The logic might be like that. Suppose I have only three genotypes. And suppose out of all cis mutations, that one I see in all of my three genotypes. Those are three genotypes which share cis effect mutation in some gene. Whether or not it doesn't have to be the same mutation. That mutation might be increasing transcript level, that mutation might be decreasing transcript level, but it is decreasing or increasing transcript level of the same gene, right? Let me ask the following question. Then out of trans factors, which of trans-affected mutations are shared between those three genotypes?
You refer to this red thing as a mutation, which means that you have a reference of that red thing in genotype 1 to an unmutated genotype.
Mm-hmm.
Do you? I mean, isn't that just a SNP that I'm...
Well, the point is that I can, in principle, tell all genes which are mutated for their transcript level if I detect that those effects are cis. This is the only logical step that I'm making, that cis means mutation in regulatory region of some gene. That's it. If I classify some gene as transcript level of this of that gene being affected by cis mutation, I am saying that this is mutation which is affecting regulation of that gene.
I'm perfectly happy with that. It's just that this notion of mutation that affects this or that implies that you're comparing two genotypes that are identical except for that particular mutation.
No, my claim is actually different.
You can subtract one from the other, which the whole problem is that you don't have that. So
my claim is different. My claim is that I can envision very simple whole genome approach to tell all the genes in the genotype which have cis regulatory mutations. That is simple.
By making a heterozygote.
By making a heterozygote. That's it. Okay. Shamil knows how to depict all the genes which are mutant for protein sequence, right? I know how to envision all mutations which affect regulatory sequences. All I'm saying, if for genotype, we know, if within a genotype, within a homozygote, we know all mutant genes, and we know what is disturbed in the genotype, we can try to reconstruct connections.
So that's the answer. So every colored dot there represents a SNP, therefore you have two versions of it, and you can...
Now, the question is, how many versions of it you need to get? And I don't again have pictures to justify my point of view, but there are at least 5 or 6 published papers in which it can be claimed that per genotype you have about 200 to 300 cis mutations which are affecting gene regulation. And they can support this statement with a bunch of citations and the request. And we have about 1,000 to 1,500 trans for given tissue, for given environment, of course. Because all our inferences will be tissue and environment specific. So we have our cis's, we have our trans. So the question is, suppose per genotype you have 200 cis. And we are dealing with 20,000 genes, right? Let's be very generous and very optimistic. So how many genotypes do we need to deal with to detect all possible connections? How many natural genotypes do we need to accomplish this goal? Let's be very simplistic. Let's say that we need to have every gene mutated at least 10 times in our sample to see what is the correlation between cis and affected trans, to pick it up from combinatorics. We actually did all those simulations in collaboration with Fenju, who is well known to some of us sitting in this room. And it turns out that 200 genotypes seem to be sufficient to reconstruct 95% of connections, provided ideas about how many cis regulatory mutations which we have per isogenic line. So this is my partial answer of what to do. It is to go for natural generic variation to try to understand what is cis, i.e. what is mutated, to combine it with the description of protein screw-ups and try to predict from that what is affected and might be further on to connect it with phenotypes. And this is the essence of Center of Excellence grant proposal that USC has submitted half a year ago, and we will see like in a month or so whether or not it is supported. Okay, sorry for depressing you with the last part. It was moving from kind of more thought out to less thought out, but at least I hope I accomplished the goal of showing you a subsample of things that we are thinking about or trying to do. And we very much appreciate interactions with colleagues and collaboration efforts. Thanks.